Howdy, folks, and welcome to Catholic Answers Focus. My name is Jimmy Akin. I'm your host today, sitting in for Cy Kellett, and we have a very interesting topic today. We're going to be talking about Dorothy Day, an activist and a Catholic convert in the 20th century, a very influential figure, and we have with us today a guest who has a special expertise in Dorothy Day. In fact, he recently gave a talk about Dorothy Day on a recent Catholic Answers Cruise event. And joining me today is our guest, Cy Kellett. Welcome to the show, Cy.
Thanks very much, Jimmy. It's really nice to be on Catholic Answers Focus.
Yeah, how about that? It's kind of a new thing.
Yeah, right. I'm just sitting in a different chair, that's all.
Yeah. So in the 1980s, I understand, you had some contact with a Boston community that was part of the Catholic Worker community, and that's an organization that grew out of Dorothy Day's efforts.
Yes.
How long were you with them?
Well, I participated, I guess, maybe 6 or 7 years. I was, you know, part of the kind of these communities tend to be kind of fluid, and I was part of that fluid community. I think living in the house, maybe 2 or 2.5 years, mm-hmm. something like that.
Were you married at the time, or were you single?
I was not. I was single, yeah.
Okay. And obviously, you have an interest in Dorothy Day. You spoke about her on the cruise. Was there a particular reason you chose that topic? Did you feel she had a particular relevance to the Catholic Answers audience?
Okay. Well, I do think she has a particular relevance. I thought for the cruise, because we were focusing on the church in America, and that, you know, all of North America. And so people were giving talks on, you know, the martyrs, the French martyrs in America, up in Canada, and giving talks on Mormonism in America and how that related to the Catholic Church experience here. Tim gave a really good talk on Cardinal Gibbons.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, well, Dorothy Day is something that I know about that is related to the church in America. You know, she's
right.
A really quintessentially American kind of Catholic in many ways. So
that doesn't mean people in other countries, like our overseas listeners, should just blow off this episode, though.
No, because of the following. I mm-hmm. also thought that this should never blow off one of the episodes.
No, of course not.
Holy smokes. How could you get through a week without Catholic Answers Focus, Jimmy?
Well,
let's be realistic here.
Okay.
So, but the other thing I think the Pope Benedict mentioned her immediately after he had announced his retirement as Pope. The first kind of papal audience that he gave after that, he spoke about how to be Christian in the modern world, or the challenges of being Christian in the modern world. And among the people that he cited there was Dorothy Day, and about her particularly modern kind of challenges she faced, and how, despite them, she found her way into the Catholic Church. And so I think because we were, you know, Catholic Answers is very concerned about, and I think our listeners are very concerned too, about the Catholic faith in the general sense, but in particular about the very serious challenges that the Catholic faith faces. I thought Dorothy Day would be a good person to discuss because she lived them.
Okay. How did you become interested in Dorothy Day? What first drew you to her and the Catholic Worker movement?
I think I first became exposed to her in college. I studied theology at Boston College, and in there, you know, probably some I did a church history class. I know where she came up. A church in America, a history of the church in America class in which she came up. And so I started to be kind of intellectually exposed to this person, Dorothy Day. And then when I was finished with my undergraduate theology degree at Boston College, I went to teach at Xaverian Brothers High School, which is outside of Boston, a boys high school, Catholic high school. Run by, you will be surprised to hear this, the Xaverian Brothers.
Oh, wow. So, what a coincidence.
Isn't that? And so one of the things that I did there as a religion teacher was retreats, lead retreats.
Mm-hmm.
And the senior retreat, one of the senior retreat options was to go and spend a weekend at the Catholic Worker House in Boston. And I think it was really good for the young men because these were seniors. They were young men at that point. But it was a revelation to me It was, I just felt so at home there.
Very moving experience.
Yeah, yeah. And like a, you know, you ever have one of those where I think I belong here, you know? Like I really felt that I belong there. And so I started to go and volunteer in the afternoons after school with meal preparation and serving. They served the elderly in the afternoon. And I just got the biggest kick out of it. I loved it. I loved being in the city, and I really liked everybody around there. And so little by little, I got more and more connected, and eventually ended up, after 3 years of teaching, saying I was ready to move on from teaching, and the place I wanted to move on to was to live in the Catholic Worker House.
Okay. Are you still a supporter of the movement today?
I am, but the movement, like so many things, needs constant reform, and I don't know that its definitive reform has happened yet. Hmm. One of the qualities of Dorothy Day's personality was a kind of looseness,
Informality?
Informality, yeah, that's right. And her leadership style was informal.
Yeah, in fact, I was in preparation for this. I did some reading about Dorothy Day, and one of the things that she commented on in her diary, for example, was the lack of control that she had over institutions that she was affiliated with, that she had a kind of moral suasion, but couldn't like order people to do things in many cases.
No, and the truth is, I don't think she wanted to. I mean, I think that she saw the consequences of it, but she was intellectually an anarchist in many ways, and so
she used the term anarchist for herself.
She did, and we'll probably talk more about that. But later in life, used a different word. But yeah, she thought of herself as an anarchist. And
is it a polite word?
Anarchist?
No, the word she used later in her life.
Oh, well, not all of them were,
okay.
but the particular word is personalism.
Personalist.
She started to use the term personalist in place of anarchist. She thought it did a better job of describing what she really was.
Okay.
But she had these anarchist ideas and tendencies. And so the Catholic Worker movement has a certain lack of focus. That is, you could go to a Catholic Worker house over here, and it's people who are very Catholic in the sacramental sense. They're practicing the faith. Or you can go to a Catholic Worker house over here, where it seems almost like kind of quasi-Buddhist or a little bit hippie, or, you know, it could be. Mm-hmm. So I really think that in my own view of it is, because I'm a Catholic, because I'm committed to being Catholic, that the possibility for a Catholic Worker house and for Catholic Worker houses to be truly Catholic, deeply, profoundly Catholic in all senses of that word, is real. And I think that it will increasingly happen. Mm-hmm. I think that's a possibility. But I can't say I'm a full-throated supporter of the movement, because the movement is so diffuse, really, in part because of Dorothy Day's leadership.
And it sounds in a way like it's kind of like, just to pick another institution, I mean, different institutions have different levels of Catholic authenticity and identity.
Yes.
And just to pick RCIA as an example, it's kind of hard to say, oh, yeah, RCIA is a great thing. Everybody ought to, you know, go to an RCIA program, because it can be so different from one city to another, from one parish to another.
Yeah.
It sounds like this is kind of the same thing. It's doing good work, but your experience, you know, your mileage may vary depending on where you are.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
Okay. Well, let's put Dorothy Day in some historical context, because we've been using her name, but a lot of people may not be familiar with her biography. Where was she from? When did she live?
She is a child of a journalist. Her father was a writer and editor, and so that meant she moved around a lot.
In New York, San Francisco, Chicago.
Those were her
main
stops. Yep, the San Francisco one is interesting, because she was a very, very small child. Her father was working as a journalist in San Francisco, but they were living across the bridge there, or across the water in Oakland.
Okay.
Because as today, Oakland is far more affordable than San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And she was about, I can't remember now, 6 or 7 years old when the great San Francisco earthquake hit.
Oh, so she was there for that.
Yeah.
And
she got slammed by the San Francisco earthquake. And it disturbed her. mm-hmm. great deal. She said later she developed and she thought she couldn't remember the order. You know how in childhood you can't always remember the order of how things happened, but she said she thought that the order was the earthquake happened and then she started getting this image of God as a frightening, loud sound coming at her. And so I think what she was saying is essentially the image of God that she got out of was an image of an earthquake. Like she was mm-hmm. terrified by it. So I think we would say that was trauma. Uh-huh. But the other thing that happened to her, and I really think this cannot be overemphasized about her, after the earthquake, people started flooding out of San Francisco because of the fire and coming over to Oakland. Many were coming to Oakland mm-hmm. by the thousands. And so she said her family gave away every stitch of clothing they had except what they were wearing, every bit of food they had. They had people staying with them. And she said that was true everywhere in Oakland, that there was this enormous spirit of hospitality and help. And I really believe that as much as the earthquake was traumatizing to her, it was also a vision of a way of being human that's much more generous mm-hmm. and much more interpersonal, you mm-hmm. know, I'll care for you kind of humanity than what is the everyday norm, you know, in America.
So it kind of touched on spiritual themes that would become prominent later in her life.
Amen, brother. That was it.
What was her religious background like as this time? How was she raised in terms of her faith?
Yeah, she was raised an Episcopalian, and she was apparently a very pious child. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, you read some of her writing and letters and things from when she was a teenager, and it seems clear that she is really very drawn to Christ and to trying to live a holy and good life. And she's also drawn to things like music and boys and all that. And so it seems like a very earnest young Christian girl trying to figure out, okay, how does that all fit with, you know, this. So they had moved to Chicago by that time.
Okay. So this is around, 1910 or something like that?
Yeah. Well, before and after 1910, but in that in that time range, yeah. And so she was born in 1897, by the way. Would have been 13 around 1910. So, yeah. And then in those early adolescent, in the pre-war years there, she's going through her adolescence and seems just to be an extraordinarily devout and really kind of a charming mm-hmm. person. She was a very attractive girl. She was just a charming person.
Her family was not as devout as she was, from what I read. That her parents kind of were nominally Episcopalian. They didn't really go to church a lot.
Right.
But at some point, a local rector convinced her mom to let her brothers sing in the church choir.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a pivotal moment that sparked more religious interest on Dorothy's part. She started reading the Bible and things like that.
Right, and really reading the Bible. I mean, she really she was very taken with God. I think she, from a very young age, she was very taken with God. And as happened with many of her generation, with the First World War and with the social movements of the time, let go of them.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me hearing about her experience growing up as a child, because in a way it mirrors my own.
Uh-huh.
My parents were nominally Protestant, but didn't go to church that much after a certain point. And I was the most religious member of the family growing up.
Uh-huh.
And I would read the Bible or parts of it. And then, like a lot of young people, I had a period where I drifted away from the faith before boomeranging back. Did something like that happen with Dorothy?
Boy, did she drift away.
Okay. Well, let's talk about that. What was her early life like as an adult?
Yeah, she went off to college. She was poor. She, you know, she had to work and pay for it herself and all that.
In fact, she even refused money from her father. And I was reading, like, would buy all of her clothes and shoes in charity stores to avoid taking money.
Right. And this all, I think, being exposed to radical ideas, being exposed to poverty herself and living with and among poor people, she began to become quite radicalized, mm-hmm. which was very common at the time.
Yeah, this was before there was much of a social safety net here in America and in other Western countries. And there was a lot of interest in socialism and communism. This is in the years leading up to the Russian Revolution in 1917.
So exactly.
She was kind of caught up in that ethos.
Exactly. And I think also attracted to the bohemian kind of life that mm-hmm. it all implied, you know, that letting go of middle class values was, I guess, seen as a kind of liberation. And I think she took it as a liberate. She was going to be liberated from that.
And her in her early 20s, it was the Roaring 20s, which was kind of a precursor of the 1960s with like a free love movement and things like that.
Right. And then she was running in kind of literary circles in New York City. She wrote a novel herself, which I have to admit I have not read.
Mm-hmm. She got a movie deal out of it, too.
She got a movie deal, which gave her some money. She bought a house on Staten Island. But I do want to say before that, she had become radicalized before the war. She had moved to New York City. She was living among the poor. She was writing for communist newspapers. And she was idolizing the leaders of the socialist and communist and anarchist world.
Mm-hmm.
And
also, we might want to mention at this time, radical was not a pejorative term. It was something people would say, I'm into radical politics and mean it positively.
Yes, exactly. Right. And, you know, I'm just watching today the riots in Germany, wherever all these young people protesting the G20 summit. And I think for them and their generation, the word radical is back to being pretty positive.
Uh-huh.
They may... But these were very these were times of great foment in that regard, and I just wanted to mention about World War I, her reaction to World War I.
Yeah,
that she was a pacifist, so she was drawn to anarchism, which has less violence associated with it in theory than communism. In the First World War, however, all her radical friends didn't want to participate in the war, wanted nothing to do with it, and also wanted to be, in a certain sense, obstructive of it. It was seen as a capitalist war where the poor were being flung together, which is not entirely an insane idea. I mean, the aspects of absolute madness in the First World War. But
And oftentimes, you know, there is a sense in wars that they're being fought for the sake of, you know,
someone's pride,
or the upper classes. Yeah. I know during the Civil War there was a protest slogan that was taken up at one point: "Rich man's war, poor man's fight."
Yeah, that's very much. I think so. That was their attitude about the First World War, and it's not an entirely insane attitude. What happened in the First World War is that the nurses of New York City were being taken into the military, not conscripted, but, you know, being asked to join the military, and they were volunteering and they were going to Europe to work as nurses. And so there was a shortage of nurses in New York City's poorest hospitals. And Dorothy Day decided to become a nurse and to work with the poor in the hospitals. And it was a life-changing thing. And a lot of her radical friends rejected her about it because she said, because they said, you're just supporting the war effort by doing that. You're just making it possible for more nurses to go overseas and be part of the war effort. And her view was, the truth is, the poor are being hurt right here, and I can do something about it. I can care for them when there's no one there to care for them,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So the bigger picture kind of dissolved for her at that point. She knew that this was the thing she should do.
This was a concrete thing she could take action on.
And nursing was gross. And, mm-hmm. you know, in a hospital of enormous poverty, it was just full of every day of terrible, you know, trials for the senses. But she embraced it and she loved it. And she says she would have stayed at it. But she is also a writer. She wanted to write. And so after a year as a nurse, then she went back to writing. I mean, she really all her life thought of herself as a journalist.
Uh-huh. Now, so World War I is like – America's involvement is like 1918, 1919 in that kind of period.
Right.
And in 1920, something very significant happened here in the United States, which was the passage of the 19th Amendment that gave women the right to vote.
Oh, I forgot about that.
And I understand that prior – to the passing of the 19th Amendment, except like in Wyoming where they always had it. But in
I'm a font of knowledge. I didn't know Wyoming was the
It was started in such a way that it was kind of a frontier state, and they had, you know, crazy ideas like let's have both men and women vote and not even make an issue of it and stuff. So, but in the rest of the country was not as forward thinking as that, and so there were protests, and it was a movement known as the Women's Suffragette movement. And I understand Dorothy Day had some involvement in that.
Yeah, she was a suffragette and she protested. It was that was perfectly consistent with the radical politics of the day, but it was also perfectly consistent with a lot of mainstream politics too. Mm-hmm. I mean, but there was, of course, a general resistance to allowing women to vote because for obvious reasons. I mean, it's just a crazy idea to have women. No, because,
dude.
You know, the status quo. I don't mean that because the status quo it defends itself. You know,
and it does.
And in the case of the suffragettes struggle, defended itself with brutal violence against women.
I mean, really. So did Dorothy experience any consequences as a result of her protesting?
She did. She went to jail in Washington, D.C. She suffered physical assault and deprivation. And when she was put into jail, the women were isolated from one another. They weren't supposed to, you know, the communication with others, with people in there was difficult. And then they all went on a hunger strike.
Right.
And
for like 10 days.
Yeah. And she did the hunger strike and eventually got out. And but she was that experience emotionally scarred her as well. But I think also gave her a sense that she was pretty tough,
mm-hmm.
too.
It also kind of set a precedent in a way because she would be arrested later on in life on a number of occasions for similar protest work. Is that correct?
She got arrested a lot. One time, I'll just tell you this, Jimmy. One time she was arrested in a Palmer raid as a prostitute. And because the
so was she serving as a prostitute at this time?
She was not, no.
Okay, but she was arrested as one.
Yeah,
that's what they charged her
because
with.
Because if you were in a house that the police had decided during the Palmer raids, if the police said this is a house of ill repute, if you were a woman who found in there, you were arrested as a woman of low morals. And she had gone because there was a woman who was working as a prostitute. And this woman had gone to stay at a house with a bunch of radical men, and she was sick. She was and she needed care. And so Dorothy went to stay with her, care for her, and got arrested. And she wrote about it later with a true sense of shame and horror because she found the experience of being thought of as a woman of low morals, of being treated by the courts that way, of being put in – she found it so shameful. And then I think she realized, you know, I think a realization came to her at that point that there's a certain kind of going to prison, which is I'm a noble person going to prison. And then there's another kind of going to prison where you're just dirt to everybody in there,
mm-hmm.
because you're thought of as just a prostitute. And that made a real mark on her too.
So she wasn't a prostitute and wasn't a woman of low morals in that sense.
No.
But in terms of her own sexual morality at this time, was she a woman of high morals?
She was a bohemian. You know, she had the bohemian morals. And so she had various partners throughout that time.
She had love affairs with different people.
Or love affairs, mm-hmm. and people she lived with, and entered into what she called a common law marriage. And
for people who may not be familiar with that term, a common law marriage is one where if you're living with somebody on an ongoing basis, after a certain amount of time, you're just considered married by the state.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be considered married by the church, but in some civil jurisdictions, if you just live with someone long enough, you're considered married for legal purposes.
All right. And this young man was named Forrester, and she says it was a common law marriage, but I don't even think they were together 7 years, which would be the minimum for an actual legal common law. I mean, she was shacking up is what it was, but she called it, you know, a common law marriage, maybe just as a way of writing about it, having a term to use for it.
Uh-huh.
And she became pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
The man was extremely resistant to any kind of religion. And she was beginning to have a religious awakening at the time. And the
she was starting to boomerang back.
Yes. She was starting to come back and she just couldn't shake God, really. I mean, it was kind of a hound of heaven deal with her a little bit, I think. And she couldn't shake God, and she realized she wanted God. And she had weird views about the Catholic Church. But among her views was she did notice, and it became important to her, that a lot of the poor people that she knew they were Catholics themselves, and their Catholicism meant a lot to them.
A lot of immigrants in like New York and Boston and places like that.
Right, and that she saw the church as kind of not as some elite organization, but as, oh, that's where those people go. Like the riffraff go to the Catholic Church. And that, to her, was a selling point, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So she was becoming closer and closer to the Catholic Church, and then she met a nun, a sister, a religious woman there on Staten Island, who began to give her some instruction. And she wavered about what this all meant. I think she just kind of didn't, like they say now, she didn't put a label on it. Mm-hmm. She just kept learning, and then she wanted her child baptized.
Okay. Now, before we get to that point, there was another previous occasion where she had also been pregnant.
Oh, I beg your pardon.
Is that right?
I forgot to mention that. That mm-hmm. is the case, and she had an abortion.
Yeah.
And I think that's a significant – because, I mean, to kind of zip forward to the end, way ahead in time, we'll get displaced.
She's heading to a good place.
She's now, I mean, being considered her cause for sainthood is under consideration in the Archdiocese of New York.
Right.
And one of the things that I think is really powerful about her life is the witness of a woman who's been through an abortion.
And found God.
And found God and really was healed, you know, and lived as one of the most prominent Catholic people in the country, maybe in the world, for decades. With this as open knowledge. And I think today there's a lot of people who are holding on to a tremendous shame, mm-hmm. even though they may have gone to confession, even though they may have, sacramentally been restored to full communion with God and with the church and all that. And I think there's something so powerful in Dorothy Day's witness mm-hmm. of taking it with confidence in Jesus, taking up the fullness of the Catholic faith and going on, despite having this, in your past.
Mm-hmm. So she's begun to reawaken religiously,
yes.
and now with a Catholic element. Rather, she'd been baptized and confirmed in the Episcopalian Church,
uh-huh.
And she's now become interested in the Catholic Church. She's got to the point of wanting her baby baptized Catholic.
Yes.
And how does her conversion play out?
Well, it plays out as a crisis for her because it's a romantic crisis as well as the essential personal choice that she's making there. And the romantic crisis comes down to this: the common law husband Forrester is a person of he sees himself as a person of science, reason, all that, and he will have nothing to do with religion. Maybe I don't know what his background was, but why he was so virulently opposed to religion. And so he doesn't want the child baptized. And if Dorothy's going to pursue this, he's not going to stay with her. Mm-hmm. He's made clear he's leaving.
So she's got a choice to make between faith and her husband.
Right, right. And so they do stay together after Tamar is baptized.
Right. I was going to say, what an interest. So their daughter is named Tamar Therese Tamar Teresa.
Yeah.
I don't know that I would name my child Tamar.
Okay. I have to tell you this. Dorothy Day says when she did that, she wasn't even familiar with the name from the Bible.
Okay. So
she said it was like a common New England name that she had heard, and she just liked it.
Okay.
But Teresa is actually
a saint's name.
Yeah, but it's a specific saint in her case. It was Teresa of Avila. She was honoring Teresa of Avila. So also a great, great woman of the church, mm-hmm. A bit of an oddity in her time. Okay, so this the choice is essentially comes down to it's God or this right. man.
But before we go to that choice, I should mention, because we mentioned the name Tamar.
Oh yeah, right.
And just to let people in on what we're talking about. So Tamar is a Hebrew girl's name. It literally means date, you know, the fruit, a date. Or it can also mean a date palm or a palm tree. But it has special resonance in the Bible. There are a couple of famous Tamars, one of them in Genesis 38, who's the daughter-in-law of Judah, and another is a daughter of David. And they're both caught up in really problematic sexual situations.
Yeah.
And so it's not the kind of name I would pick for my daughter.
It's funny because she does know the Bible, but she apparently
didn't know those
missed
bits.
That part, because
yeah.
she later said, no, it had nothing to do with that. She just said it was a common name that was going around in New England at the time. And she was attracted to it.
So, okay. So now we're up to the choice she has to make.
Yeah. And eventually she does choose for baptism. And she comes into the Catholic Church. But the truth is she's still very isolated from the Catholic community.
Mm-hmm.
It's all been a very intellectual journey for her in a way. And
radical politics were not the most popular thing in a lot of Catholic circles.
Well,
at
there's
time.
The number one anti-communist organization in the history of the world is the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
I mean, that's – there's thank you for saying yeah, because there's no dispute of that.
Yeah.
So to be Catholic is in many ways to be – well, it is to be in the world's most foremost anti-Catholic organization. I mean, anti-communist organization. And she's kind of a communist.
Yeah.
So she remains a bit isolated.
Yeah. Now, she's not a formal member of the Communist Party. She never joined that. In fact, she did believe in private property.
Right. She did.
And defended that. She later wrote in defense of an economic philosophy called distributism.
Yeah.
Which is popularized by like Hilaire Belloc and G.K. Chesterton in Catholic circles.
Right.
It's sort of midway between – I mean, it has some elements of socialism but some elements of capitalism, and she kind of advocated that for a while. Is that correct?
Yeah, it is. And the thing about – this is also – I mean, she's an agrarian at heart, even though she's urban her whole life. And distributism – is sometimes called distributivism as well, mm-hmm. is fundamentally agrarian. I mean, at its roots, it's the idea is everybody should get to own their own tools. And so – and then you should own a little bit of land, and you should be a farmer on the land, or you should be a machine maker, but or whatever, a shoemaker.
Right.
But you should have your own tools in your own little spot. That's
– it's kind of big on self-reliance.
Yeah, and it means distributing – basically
the ownership of the means of production,
right, to as many people as possible, not holding them collectively. And I think that's one of the interesting things about her. She never really was a collectivist.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't believe in collectivism, which is essential to communism.
Right. So in a communist or collectivist form of socialism, you'd have a collective that owns like
everything.
All the farm equipment, all of the land, and you just kind of work there and share it with everybody.
Right.
In a I guess at the other extreme, in a capitalist setting, it could be owned either by individuals or by like big gigantic corporations.
Right.
And so this idea is trying to be a sort of midpoint where
right.
the farm equipment and the land and stuff is neither owned by a giant faceless collective or a giant faceless corporation, but by individuals.
Yeah. I don't know how realistic it is. I mean, we're not. It's increasingly clear that humanity is not going to be agrarian. I mean, I suppose we could choose it. We could make a radical choice to all go back to the land, but I can't even imagine how that would work for 7 or 9 or 10 billion people. So it has its limits, but mm-hmm. I suppose every economic theory has its limits.
Yeah,
no one's invented.
But there's still a some value in saying, okay, we want individuals empowered.
Amen.
To
right. that's
a
the,
reasonable extent.
That's the key.
Yeah.
Yes, that is the key. Right. And so that's where she – so the anarchism was, I think, a way of saying I'm radical, but I'm not communist. Mm.
So she wasn't an anarchist in the sense of let's smash all governments and have no law in society.
Mm, maybe not smash, okay. but the rest of it, probably she was.
Okay.
And sometimes smash. Uh-huh. I mean, sometimes she got a little. So she was very sympathetic to all her friends and neighbors mm-hmm. and whoever who were communists. She just couldn't. She was anarchist because there was something about that individual that was so important to her. I do think it was related to her religious faith.
Well, and she would even kind of subvert. I mean, her communist friends would criticize her and say, like, well, how can you believe all this religion stuff? And she would kind of turn it around on them and say, actually, by valuing the worker and the poor and the downtrodden, you're, without realizing it, promoting Christian values.
which is true, right. But she also saw that all these poor and the downtrodden, they were religious people. And it was kind of a con to say, well, overcoming religion is the way to help the poor.
Mm-hmm.
And then she became religious herself, and I guess we're past that point. So yeah. Now she's a Catholic.
Okay, so let's pair her with one of her Catholic contemporaries. Mother Teresa.
Okay.
Mother Teresa, you know, was living, lived longer than Dorothy Day, but they're yeah. rough contemporaries. They're both very concerned with the poor.
Right.
But they have somewhat different approaches. What can you tell us about that?
Well, I do think some of that, both of those women would tell you, has to do with where they were, that there were different needs in Calcutta than there were in New York City.
Okay.
And that the, that, but that
New York needs better Indian food, yeah. Or at the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, probably has better Indian food now.
Yeah.
But the essential thing that I do think that both would have shared was this sense that Christ called you personally to get up off your duff and well, Mother Teresa might not have used the word duff, but to care directly for the person
who's suffering.
And Mother Teresa called it the five-finger gospel. Have you ever heard of that, the five-finger gospel?
Her mother taught it to her. The five-finger prayer.
No, five-finger gospel, you did it for me.
Oh, okay.
So whatever you did for the poor, you did it for me. So
from
one word.
Matthew 25.
Yeah, whatever you did for the hungry or whatever you did for the naked, you did it for. So that was the five-finger gospel. That was something that Dorothy would have agreed on, but they would have said they were in places that needed totally different things. So that's one of the things.
Okay.
The other, I do think, is the difference between being a woman religious and being a lay woman. That
right. Now, this is very significant, very interesting, because at this point in Dorothy's life, the Second Vatican Council is still, you know, decades away. And there's a common view at the time that's kind of clericalism. It's related to clericalism, even though if you don't need to be a priest to do something in the church, you at least need to be like a nun.
Yeah, right.
And the laity don't really have large leadership roles in a lot of cases.
Right.
These kind of lay ministries hadn't yet taken off. There were still individuals that did, and Dorothy is an example of that. She's kind of an early lay leader.
Exactly. And I think that she... that just seemed to come naturally to her. That fit with all of what she was before she was a Catholic, that we should do this ourselves. We should be taking responsibility for doing in the world what Christ called us to do. And we shouldn't be waiting for a priest to tell us. As a matter of fact, we should maybe scoot the priest along if he's not mm-hmm. quite with the program of the gospel, you know. And so Dorothy Day, she had a daughter, which she... entering religious life wouldn't have comported with raising her daughter.
Right. Though she did become an oblate.
And then she later in life became an Benedictine oblate.
Right.
And then but then also I think it comported with what she wanted to do, was to normalize this kind of life that she was living, to say, this is for everybody. You should be – now, she didn't believe that everyone should be living in a Catholic worker house. As a matter of fact, she didn't believe that they were good places to raise children, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not good places to raise children. For a whole variety of reasons. But her calling really, I do believe, was as a laywoman. Mother Teresa's was the founding of an order. And so they were different in that way. I think lots of people want to say, well, Mother Teresa is like charity and Dorothy Day is like justice. As a matter of fact, I've heard this said many times.
You know, okay.
Dorothy Day wanted to stand up to power and make the world a just place. And Mother Teresa didn't care about standing up to power and making the world a just place. She just wanted to do charity. And sometimes that's used to denigrate Dorothy Day, and sometimes that's used to denigrate Mother Teresa. And in either case, it's wrong. That's not at all what they were. I mean, Mother Teresa spent a great deal of her life protesting and standing up for justice. I mean, specifically, I remember her standing right in the face of a prominent American politician and saying—
President Clinton.
Yeah, okay, all right. So you're saying, basically, knock it off. With abortion.
Yeah.
And she was not afraid to stand up for what was just. And Dorothy Day
did a lot of charity.
And Dorothy Day spent her life in charities, pouring out her life in caring for those right next to her all the time.
Now, you've mentioned, and we touched on this at the beginning of the show, but you've mentioned again Catholic worker houses. Those are an outgrowth of a movement that Dorothy Day started in, I guess, the 1930s during the Great Depression that were kind of based around a newspaper that she had started called The Catholic Worker.
Right.
And does that newspaper still exist?
It does. Yep. There was the most prominent communist newspaper in America for decades was The Daily Worker. And so it takes its name kind of from The Daily Worker, but obviously from a Catholic angle.
Mm-hmm.
It was an immediate success. It was Peter Morin who was a French peasant. He was a religious who had left his religious order, and he was kind of itinerantly just trying to do gospel stuff everywhere he went, you know. Mm-hmm. And he met Dorothy Day, and she was so taken with him. And he said, start a newspaper. And she said, I don't have the funds to start a newspaper. And he said, you don't need the funds. Jesus will find the funds. Mm-hmm. So she looked into it, and it turned out she basically did have the funds. And it wasn't going to cost very much, and that by selling the paper for a penny a copy, she could cover the costs of it as long as she didn't care about making any money off of it.
Right.
So she started The Catholic Worker. The Catholic Worker became very popular, lost all its popularity, became very popular again, lost all its popularity again, but it still exists.
Okay. Now, so she started this newspaper and this movement, and she's advocating these ideas that are kind of edgy from the mainstream American society perspective at the time.
Right.
How were her relations with the church hierarchy?
Mixed, I would say. You know,
were there particular flashpoints?
I'm trying to remember Cardinal Cook, I believe.
Spellman.
Spellman, yeah.
She of New York.
Yeah, she would have run-ins with, but so did Fulton Sheen. So I don't know. Spellman was. It's turning out that
he's had some fractious relations with people who are up for sainthood.
Right. He was tough on saints. It's also true that she was widely accepted in the Catholic hierarchy in many ways. Mm-hmm. Her writing became very well accepted in places like Common Wheel magazine, that kind of thing, and in the Catholic Worker. She ran into trouble, I think, sometimes because even more than her work with the poor was she was a pacifist.
Uh-huh.
And she remained a pacifist.
Outgrowth of her nonviolence. And so World War II, when everyone is all fired up to go defeat the Nazis, she's saying, wait, let's be pacifists?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that didn't go over
that's
real good.
That was the first time the paper's popularity just crashed.
Okay.
I mean, I think she went from 150 subscribers down to about 10,000 in a matter of weeks because she believed that not just that the war was unjust, but that war was unjust.
Okay. So she was not a supporter of just law, of just war theory.
No, she was not.
It's interesting, you know, because she was nonviolent, she was pacifist. I found on a previous occasion, just when you and I were talking here in the office, I think you commented about how she could be kind of inconsistent with herself.
Well, and that was a private conversation, Jay.
Well, okay, I found some evidence of that doing a show prep for today, because I was reading a quote from 1960 where she was talking about Fidel Castro, who had just taken over Cuba. He just staged a revolution there. He had not yet said we're communists. So there was a kind of up in the air quality about which way is he going to go.
Right.
But she apparently said, in commenting on his revolution, far better to revolt violently than to do nothing about the poor destitute. So a nonviolent pacifist says it's better to revolt violently than I mean, that would suggest on some occasions the use of violence is warranted.
I have No comment, Jimmy. No, yeah. I mean, it's clear, yeah. And you're right. That was the early days of Castro's revolution. And there was certainly a great deal of injustice in Cuba and all that. But I do think there's a kind of, myself, I think there is a kind of intellectual inconsistency there. Mm-hmm. That maybe she, now she's lived another 20 years right. beyond that. Yeah. And that, and in her later years, I think, some that maybe dissipated somewhat, but she, I don't agree with. I mean, I can't justify that statement. I'm not trying to say I'm not an apologist for Dorothy Day, but I do think
I'm not. As a supporter of just war theory, I would say, well, there are situations in which the use of violence is warranted. I'm just. It's interesting to see that it looks inconsistent with other things she said.
Yeah, it does. I mean, I suppose there's a way you could make it consistent by saying, well, she didn't say it's good. She just said it's better than. But so she didn't make it an absolute good. But the truth is, I mean, how are you going to support Fidel Castro's violent revolution and say, I'm a pacifist. Yeah. So I do think let's admit it. There's an element of intellectual inconsistency there.
Okay. So we're up to the 1960s now, and we're at the beginning of the 60s with the Cuban Revolution. But as the 60s progress,
yes.
there's a big cultural revolution here right. in the Western world with the rise of the counterculture. And I understand that Abby Hoffman, a leader in the 1960s counterculture,
right.
at one point told Dorothy Day that he thought she was the original hippie.
Yeah.
That was the quote.
Yeah.
How would she respond to that? What did she make of the hippie movement?
Well, after throwing up, she probably... No, I shouldn't make it that extreme. Look, Dorothy Day, this is something that I think should not be discounted or just glossed over. She was a truly Catholic woman. Her conversion to the Catholic faith was deep and real and she wanted to fully live as a Catholic woman. That was, she didn't have some other aspiration. And so the idea that the sexual libertinism of the 60s and particularly the hippies would have appealed to her is not true. It didn't. She spoke out against it at the time. She wasn't interested in people taking drugs. Mm-hmm. She wasn't interested in marriage being trivialized. She was a solid Catholic woman who opposed abortion, opposed contraception. And so she is a radical, but she's not that kind of – she's not an Abby Hoffman radical.
Right. In fact, I have a quote here I found where she's talking about sexual mores, and she says, when sex is treated lightly as a means of pleasure, it takes on the quality of the demonic. And to descend into this blackness is to have a foretaste of hell. There is no such thing as seeing how far one can go without being caught or how far one can go without committing mortal sin. So by this point in her life, she's fully on board with Catholic sexual morality.
Yeah. Yeah, she was. And I think she was because for Dorothy Day, holiness was not something to be sneezed at. It's just that she – I think one way to think about her is – her definition of holiness would not allow her to say, well, I'm holy so long as I'm not in a state of mortal sin. Her holiness was a positive thing for her, something to be striven after, and it included service to the poor as an essential element, not as a nice thing that you do in addition.
Jesus was kind of big on that too, I think.
I think so too, Jimmy. That's why I think she's powerful a messenger for the Catholic faith in that regard.
Now, she continued to be active through the 1970s and continued to edit the Catholic Worker until her death. When did she die and how did she die?
She died in 1980, but she had been somewhat bedridden or very low activity for 5 years before that. In 1975, I think I'm getting my years right here. Mm-hmm. In 1975, she was speaking in Philadelphia. She was, by the mid-70s, she was a major Catholic figure. Like Dorothy Day was coming to your town. It was going to be a big crowd, see her.
And she was sort of an American Mother Teresa of her day.
Yeah, she was. And by the way, she had gone to Calcutta and met with Mother Teresa, and Mother Teresa had invited her to speak to her novices, and she had spoken to the novices. And so
– and they were both kind of controversial figures in some ways.
They were, right. And the idea of juxtaposing them against one another is obnoxious to me. But I do think certain people want to do that, and I don't think that that's right. They certainly wouldn't have done it to one another. But so she's a major Catholic figure.
You mean pitting them as antagonists, not just compare and contrast?
Yeah, right, yeah. Right. But yeah, to imply that they're one is more authentically Catholic than the other or something. Although Mother Teresa is a saint.
Well, so, she got there first.
She got there, right. And not by dying first.
Right.
And so the so in 75, she was given a talk in Philadelphia, and a nurse came up to her after and said, "You're sick. You're not well," because of her breathing and her pallor and all that. And she found out she was in heart failure, and she needed to start taking medicine after that. And then she was on very minimal activity for 5 years before mm-hmm. her death.
And then she passed on from a heart attack.
She did, right. And her daughter Tamara was with her mm-hmm. there.
I read that during her funeral, you know, they were having a funeral procession that went, you know, like a lot of places you move from the church to the cemetery and things like that. And Cardinal Terence Cooke greeted her funeral procession. And so there was some reconciliation with the hierarchy at that point, or at least an expression of reconciliation that had already occurred. And then eventually the cause for her sainthood was opened.
Yeah.
And so now she's not a saint yet. No. What's her current status?
You stumped me, Jimmy.
She's a servant of God.
I thought I was going to say it, but then I was I don't know exactly where she is. Okay, so yeah. Servant of God, Dorothy Day, yeah.
So that signifies she's her cause has been opened, and yep. they're doing an investigation of her life.
Right.
The next step would be if they find she lived a life of heroic virtue, they would declare her venerable.
Yep.
And then if a miracle is attributed to her intercession, then she could be declared a blessed, a beatus. And then if another is found that can be attributed to her intercession, then she could be declared a saint.
Yep.
And by coincidence, just a few days ago, I was contacted on Facebook by a gentleman who had a cancer diagnosis recently and is asking people to pray for him for healing through the intercession of Dorothy Day.
Oh, let's do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad to hear that. And come on, Dorothy. Yeah. Let's get on that, man.
Where can people learn more about Dorothy Day if they want to find out more about her life and her thoughts and her activities?
CatholicWorker.org is one place. I think it's .org. Is it?
Yeah, it's CatholicWorker.org.
But you can I recommend the book, The Long Loneliness.
That's her biography.
Right. And she wrote a couple – I mean, Loaves and Fishes is kind of a biography as well, and that's a good one.
That's about the Catholic worker movement.
Right. And then her – but her last book, I think it's her last book, is The Long Loneliness. And it's a beautiful book. It's beautifully written. She really was a very good writer, a mm-hmm. very, very good writer. Worth reading. For a lot of reasons, but if you enjoy good writing, she's very good.
Okay, so CatholicWorker.org, The Long Loneliness, yep. Loaves and Fishes, and what was the last book that you mentioned?
I think those were the only ones I mentioned.
Oh, okay, yeah. Okay. So some additional resources there, so you can learn more about prospective, maybe future Saint Dorothy Day and her life and work. Si, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a pleasure as always. Where can people connect with you online?
They can send me an email if they want. I'll give out my email address is ckellett, 2 L's, 2 T's, @catholic.com. And then
Facebook and Twitter?
Facebook, Twitter, and occasionally. Yeah, you know what we do, Jimmy. We do the show right here live on Facebook 5 days a week.
Frequently, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, listen, thank you so much for being with us, Si. And thank you for listening to the show. And join us again next week on Catholic Answers Focus.